Exit number 11909, Reel 2.
Mr. Gold, Reel 2.
There was a famous phrase, Hausa phrase, which was in very common currency, Barkomi, meaning, oh, don't worry. And words like this, most of us got accustomed to using. Unless you had a terrific linguistic block, it wasn't difficult to make yourself understood in this sort of pidgin English, liberally besprinkled with a few Hausa words. And most of us tried very hard to do that as much as possible because we felt, I think rightly, that it gave us more fellow feeling with the Africans than if we simply spoke in very stilted Queen's English.
Did you like your African soldiers?
I did, yes, very much so. I had a considerable admiration for them and quite a lot of sympathy for them, particularly, as I've said, they didn't, most of them, I'm sure, understand really what they were doing or why they were doing it. They understood what they were doing, thank goodness, but not why they were doing it.
Did they have a nickname for you?
For me, personally? If they did, I was never told it.
Now, can you tell me how they reacted to India when you got there?
I can give you perhaps one example. I was the baggage officer in my battalion at that time, and I had to spend most of my time when we landed at Bombay at, on the wharf side getting all our heavy cases and stuff of ammunition, goods and so forth, loaded up onto lorries. And the dock authorities had provided a number of, I presume they would be called dockers, dock labourers, who were, I believe, called Gattis. They were rather small and looked to me slightly wizened little men with a certain amount of willingness, but very little muscle. And two of my Africans were standing with me and watched four of these Gattis trying hard to pick up a large case and finding it rather difficult. And after a bit, they could wait no longer. They brushed these four aside. One gestured to the other one. They humped it up between them, put them on the heads of one of them, and off he went with it, which seemed to me to typify their attitude to the Indians. They were much more muscular and strong, and I think they felt a sense of superiority of those Indians whom they saw, obviously the poorer type. But they didn't seem to be filled with as much interest and wonder at the various sights they saw on the subcontinent, as indeed most of us were.
How can you explain that?
I don't think they had quite such an outward-looking mind. They were more concerned with their sort of everyday life and where the next meal was coming from, this sort of thing.
So they didn't pass comments on India and the Indians?
No. Not really, except that they said they evidenced considerable contempt at the lack of muscle, as I say, that was evidenced now and then. They chuckled amongst themselves over that, but for the most part, they showed a surprising, I suppose one would say, lack of interest.
Do you know the month that you arrived at Bombay?
I think it was the beginning of September 1943.
Now, can we pick up the narrative, please, and can you tell me what happened to your unit after arrival in India?
Yes. We moved to a camp about 80 miles north of Bombay, which is where we landed, a place called Nazik, and really merely regrouped and got ourselves organized, ready for what turned out to be a long trek across India, 5-day train journey, which was very nice from a scenic point of view, but rather wearying. We arrived at Chittagong, the end of the train journey, in the northernmost part of the Arakan, just around the Bay of Bengal to the east. From there, we went by transport to our base camp, which was Chiringa. And in due course, we started off down towards the eastern part of the Arakan Peninsula, basically the valley of the River Caladan. To do this, we had to go over hill ranges, and we had to, our African troops had to construct a roadway known as the West African Way. This went on for 75 miles until we got down into the valleys of the Caladan River near the village of Caladan.
When would this be, the approximate that you reached that?
This would be about the turn of the year 43-44, probably early January 44. We then made our way down the side of the Caladan River, and you like me to go straight on with the sort of campaign story? And we then received information that the Japs were mounting their, what turned up one of their big offensives, and at this time their main thrust came to the west of us, towards the coast, and that culminated in one of the more famous incidents of the first campaign, the Battle of the Admin Box, as it was called. Excuse me. We didn't have any direct contact with that, although geographically we were only about 30 miles to the east, but the Japs were coming up in force on our side of the mountain ranges also, and my battalion was involved in one very sticky incident at that time, which came to be known afterwards as the Battle of Cox's Corner, Cox being the colonel in charge of our battalion. This was on the 6th and 7th of March of 1944, and I was, through no particular reason, in the forefront of this, because one of our rifle companies, C Company, had been asked to move out eastward to test the Japanese dispositions, and my mortar section was attached to that company. We hadn't gone very far from battalion headquarters, about a mile and a half, when the C Company, which was slightly ahead of my mortar section, was engaged in crippling fire, machine gun fire, from both sides of its point of advance. The company commander and second in command were both killed instantly, and after having mounted my mortars and found the range of at least one side of the Japanese attacking position and disposed of quite a number of them by the sound of things, I was somewhat perturbed to find all the visible members of C Company, both white and black, retreating past me back towards the battalion at quite a considerable rate of knots. So I thought the only thing to do was to join them, which I did, and got all my mortar section back. And we found that the company had been really completely taken by surprise. The battalion then regrouped and held its position until it could withdraw and resumed the campaign later on in a slightly different direction. But that was the one rather unpleasant incident in this first campaign. The rest of it really was just steady, if slightly laborious, progress in the daytime.
How had the Japanese mounted their attack at Cox's Corner?
Well, they had obtained positions on the higher ground on both sides of what was obviously the track. You went along the fairly level ground with all your forces in sort of a strung out Indian file. I think our people were rather green at this point and hadn't realised the necessity of probing scout patrols early on, and they were quite frankly ambushed, completely ambushed. The Japs were much closer, clearly, than we had had any reason to believe until this ambush occurred, and there was nothing one could do but carry out a hasty, slightly undignified retreat.
Where exactly was this in the Caledon Valley?
This was on the basic and main tributary of the Caledon River called the Pichong, P-I, Pichong, which was a fairly wide river itself at this point. And it was just along the banks of this Pichong that encountered these Japs. There's the Pichong going down there, and there's Cox's Corner there.
You're just showing me it's on the map.
It's on the map. The Caledon River comes down to the east of us, and we were on this Pichong, which joined the Caledon River at this point where we had this encounter.
At the confluence near a place called Walaga.
That's correct. That's correct.
About how many Japanese do you think ambushed you?
I would think there were probably 200 or 300. Difficult to tell. I mean, in the jungle, numbers seem more sometimes than they are. And certainly, with the Japs, it was our experience that they appeared to make such good use of the ground and were so determined that a mere handful could resist you with almost with the effect of a company, because they dug themselves in, and you couldn't, you could, but it was ineffective largely to grenade them, because they were so densely ensconced amongst the bamboo trees that grenades would very likely not reach their objective.
What kind of intelligence were you getting about the Japanese?
Now, this was possibly the weakness. There was very little intelligence one could get except by one's own patrols, and we hadn't, I think it's fair to say, developed the art of systematic and useful patrolling by this time. It was our... Well, it was within 6 weeks or so of having entered the jungle and within about a month of our first contact with the Japs, and I suppose all along we were learning.
Did the setback have an effect on the morale of the troops?
Fortunately not. Fortunately not. They soon resumed their normal attitude. It was a bit shaking at the time, I think, to all of us who were involved, and particularly as we lost two of our senior officers. But no, they soon recovered. In fact, there was too much to do, so to speak, to sit down and bemoan the situation.
Can you take the narrative on further, please?
Yes, I must admit that apart from these outstanding incidents, my memory becomes a little bit obscured after all these years. We then went on down the Caledon and crossed it to one of the principal, I won't dignify the title of towns, one of the principal larger villages there called Choktaw. And on the other side of this village of Choktaw, there was a large hill with a pagoda on it, and obviously this became known as Pagoda Hill. And that was our main objective. However, With the successful repulse of the Japanese invasion at the Battle of the Admin Box, it was then felt that that first campaign had done as achieved as much in the holding sense as it could be expected to, and we swung round to the west from there and went across the low ground, having got over the first range, across the low ground, and came out of the Arakan through Tong Bazaar and retired to, first of all, to Chittagong, and then across to base camp, which was near Madras. However, before long, we were involved in coming back in again by the same route, which we did. And this followed roughly the same idea of pushing down and repelling the Japs through the thick part of the jungle around the Caladan Valley. Again, we came in by this main tribute of the Caladan, the Pai Chong, and the Japs by this time were definitely on the defensive. They were withdrawing. Found they hadn't got quite such an easy job as they had expected earlier that year. And the pattern was really very very regular. During the daytime, we had to proceed as best we could and make the most of the daylight, because we had what would in modern parlance be called complete air supremacy. The American Dakotas were in complete charge of air, and we could call up airstrikes whenever we wanted them on a particularly obdurate Japanese position. The only thing was that, well, this is unfortunately a little bit topical at the moment also, that one could not always rely upon the accurate map reading of the striking American pilots. And if you called for an airstrike on a hill, you were well advised to withdraw a considerable distance from that in case they struck the wrong hill, which on two occasions we had found. However,
can you describe the occasions when they hit the wrong people?
Well, no, I wasn't personally involved in that, but I was told of it that there weren't any serious casualties. In fact, I don't know there were any fatal casualties at all, but an unpleasant time was enjoyed by those of our troops who had confidently been expecting to see the enemy's position bombed, and they found them falling unpleasantly close to themselves. However, that, as I say, didn't occur often, but one had to be fairly careful. But we did, for these reasons, have complete superiority during the daytime. At night, of course, the airplanes couldn't operate in the jungle, and the Japs, who had pretty good 75mm guns, they took over, and they usually gave us a very uncomfortable time at night. Nothing that I'm aware of that caused great casualties, if any, to a great extent at all. But certainly they kept us our heads down, so to speak, at night during most of this campaign. The area, as I say, was moving south-west down the elements of the Pai Chong and the Caladan River, past Chok Tor, and with the intention of going further east of the Caladan River to Mae Hong. We had already been told, and we're now talking about the latter part of 1944, been told that the 82nd West African Division would come through us at Mae Hong and take on from there. So their objective was to get to Mae Hong. There wasn't anything particularly exciting or unusual that occurred there. It was merely a question of probing forward, seeing where the Japs were, and moving them out, either by a frontal attack or preferably by gunfire and a distant bombardment. But the great problem there was elements of the Jap army which had been left behind either inadvertently or possibly by design to disrupt our advance. And I can instance you one example of a sort of hazard which I personally found. I was at that time with a rifle company, and we had the previous day sent out two African patrols because we had reports that there were Jap elements in the vicinity, in what strength we didn't quite know. These two African-led patrols came back without much information, possibly because they hadn't been able to get a proper use of the maps. They were not being so well acquainted with map reading. So I was asked to go out the next day, put one patrol out in one direction and take another one on down the banks of the Pai Chong myself, after having done that. This started off quite all right, and I sent the other patrol off in its direction and went on down the bank of the Pai Chong. Now, the cover and vegetation at that time, well, it was a sandy bank with very high elephant grass in patches, but long, or fairly long, areas of open ground. We were going down fairly slowly down here, and I was getting a little bit impatient, and I said to my scouts in front, "Get on, get on." And they evidenced considerable anxiety, as if they didn't like this the area. However, I told them to get on with it, and we just got through another patch of elephant grass and were out in an open bit of about 30, 40 yards of sandy ground, when suddenly we were opened up on from across the water, obviously by a Jap machine gun or two. The water at this stage was about 100 yards wide, the river, and it was too far for me or my orderly, who was behind me, to make for cover. So we both flung ourselves down the sand. The two scouts had just got into the cover ahead of us, but the African sergeant with us lost his nerve momentarily and tried to double back past us back to cover behind us, and he was shot in the jaw, but he managed to make it to the cover. And there we were, lying on the ground in a not very comfortable position. And as I fell, my hat fell off and they could see my white skin, so they made me a fair target because they're best to pick off the European officers. And I had a machine gun emptied right at me. Their aim, fortunately, was lamentable. In fact, all I got was two bullet holes through my trouser leg. But it obviously couldn't go on like this for long, and I was just wondering what to do, if anything, when, to my intense amazement, I heard a Japanese voice calling out in English, "Stop, stop, stop firing." And this absolutely astounded me, but I wasn't so astounded as not to realise that was my chance, and I leapt up and dived for cover. So did my orderly, although he collected a bullet in the ankle in the process of doing it. And we then dived into the undergrowth, made our way back, and ultimately we joined the rest of the patrol and got back home. But why, firstly, did the Jap call out to them to stop firing? I can only assume that he thought that he had either, if not killed, at least severely wounded two of us and was hoping to get some information. Or it That was that one. And that was emphasized by the fact that in the moment before I leapt to my feet, I could hear some splashing, because the Chong was obviously fordable at this point, and therefore they were coming across. But why, my second question later was, why did a Japanese officer talk to presumably his Japanese troops in English? Could never understand that.
Could it have been that they might have been Indian National Army troops working with the Japanese?
You know, that has never occurred to me, but it is not by any means impossible, because they did have a lot of these INA. It could be that. Yes, I suppose that might be.
When and where was this?
This was on the 24th of November, 1944, as it was my closest brush. The date sticks in my mind.
And
it was on the edge of the Taichung, not far from a village called Ridong, R-I-D-A-U-N-G.
Were your troops shaken after this incident?
The boys on that patrol were slightly shaken. None more than my orderly, who was a very sound egg and completely devoid of fear. But he was a little shaken after this one. As indeed we all were. But I can only be extremely thankful that the Japanese marksmen were so unbelievably poor as not to be able to get one bullet into a inert body at about 100 yards range from a machine gun out of a whole clip. I can't imagine.
Did the Japanese have a poor reputation for marksmanship?
Well, not universally, other than the fact that their eyesight is normally regarded to be not too good. I mean, you see more Japs, I think, with glasses than most races. But other than that, no, I don't think so. Their marksmanship, their sort of technical marksmanship, was always quite good, you know, with artillery and so forth. But certainly, they may have got too excited over this. They probably thought they had an easy time. But certainly, it was a remarkable escape, I thought. And after that type of campaign, we then moved on down. We crossed the river again as before at opposite Choctaw, and we were then in fairly easy ground, fairly level ground, and moved on towards Myahong. And at that point, as designed, in I think this would be about early May, the 82nd Division came along through and took over the probe, and we then, three of our companies were flown out by Dakotas and back to Chiringa, and thence back to our base, and two of us, my company was one, were elected to march out. We hadn't got enough air transport to take everybody out by air. The terrain was, as I said often, extremely hilly. It was, as the map said, dense mixed jungle, mainly bamboo. And that was the